So Abner, One UI 7, delayed, already delayed beyond delay.
Yeah.
Not very good, is it?
It's a weird one, especially as we're on the precipice of Android 16 here. So what have you been using One UI 7 on?
I've been using it on the... Well, I tried the beta release on the S24 Ultra, and then my personal unit is the S25 Ultra, which I've kind of flip-flopped between, and I think the update's fantastic. I don't understand how we've gone from having S25 Ultra launching in February, and we're now, what, coming up 3 months since then? The beta released slightly before that as well, and Samsung's still no closer to actually being able to legitimately roll out a version of Android 15.
Yeah, I've been using it on the Flip 6, and it's... I don't know, it feels heavier, just to recap things. It feels a bit heavier than what came before. Like the quick settings, it's not my daily driver by any stretch, but when I do use it once or twice a day, it still feels a bit heavier to me than what came before, and Android in general, Pixel Android in general. But live activities have been the biggest deal. I'm probably using it more there than on Android 16 beta, which is funny. So the intention there is to copy the dynamic island on the iPhone, and I think it's too small. The status bar is way too small for it to be effective. That's my biggest gripe.
I would like to see more interactivity with it, but the frustrating thing is that I'm guessing. So you must have had your device in that first wave of devices in the US updated to it.
The beta.
So you're currently still in the beta program. Okay, like for me, all of these things that we've kind of seen for it feels like 6 months. I don't even think it is 6 months of like Samsung preparing for this release, and then what are we coming up 7 months since Android 15 was released in stable for Pixel devices? Like you say, it's on the precipice of Android 16. And if you're a Samsung owner of, say, an S24 or something like that, you've spent a lot of money on it, and then we're still potentially having to deal with frustrations and little things that hopefully will get fixed in the Android 16 update when that does arrive. But yeah, I think in terms of just going back to the good stuff, I do like the visuals. I think the visuals are a big thing for Samsung. There's at least a differentiation here with what potentially they were doing before. Everything felt a little bit not necessarily cohesive. In fact, that could be the way to describe it. I like the fact that, like you say, the quick settings is quite well thought out. You kind of can have a hybrid approach that you can't really have.
I don't disagree that it's well thought out. It's this clear separation. It makes sense the UI, but it just feels so heavy, and it's like taking the quick out of quick settings, don't you think? When it becomes its own UI, I have the same issue with the current state of iOS control center. When you swipe down from the top right corner, it feels like it's own home screen. It's getting to the point where it's kind of like its own home screen with widgets and whatnot. And I think that's getting a bit too heavy. I don't know. I just feel like quick settings should be quick. It should be light, minimal, on-off toggle interactions versus what we're starting to get here with rich UIs with own partition sections. I don't know. Too much for me.
I hadn't even thought, to be fair, I hadn't even thought of it like that until you just mentioned it. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think maybe we moved so far away from that basic quick section, emphasis on the quick. It's more a case of like, it is a landing page now of its own. So I wonder, like, maybe the iOS approach of initially creating that separation was a bad thing in some respects, because everything feels like it's crammed in. But I guess Samsung and to another extent OnePlus and Oppo, they've done this two-page thing where you do have your quick settings. I think it's a right swipe, right
column
swipe.
You can obviously turn it off in the case of Samsung.
Yeah, you can. I think you can do the same on OnePlus and Oppo devices as well. And I can, like, for the traditionalists, you like to have quick settings and notifications in the same place. and then it starts to feel congested again. Yeah, it is a strange. I don't know who decides these. How is it analyzed? Who decides where things go? And how? What are the defaults, if that makes sense, for those quick settings toggles? I still feel like Google's probably had a hand in that, because everyone seems to have this big Bluetooth and Wi-Fi toggle, and I don't know why that's a thing. I don't understand why that's become a thing.
How often do you turn off Bluetooth? It's my question. When it like kind of breaks because you can't pair something,
yeah, basically. Basically, that's it. If I can't pair with something, I turn it off and then I turn it back on, or sometimes with Android Auto in the car, but I use AA wireless, so that's technically Wi-Fi. Yeah. So yeah, no, that's a really good point. Why is Bluetooth given this higher prominence? I guess the ubiquity of Bluetooth accessories, maybe.
Yeah, and there's the menu of being able to select different devices too. It's sure.
But is that not negated by the fact we have FastPair now with basically anything that's released after a certain time?
I don't really need to access the Switch for ages, I guess.
Maybe we're diving into something here we hadn't potentially grappled with, because there are a lot of little things that don't make a lot of sense in Android, period. And I feel like One UI probably was one of the worst offenders of that. Like, they would just do things for the sake of doing things. And maybe it was derived from the fact that they saw iOS do it and we added it. But that's why I feel like this year I've been really kind of pleasantly surprised with One UI. I get what you mean by it being heavy. It does feel, in terms of like, if you've come from Pixel specifically, and I know you like me are a Pixel aficionado, we've loved Pixel devices for its simplicity in some ways. Maybe I've used Pixel and Nexus for so long that I kind of felt the need to go back to something a little bit extra, if that makes sense. Like, I need all of those. I need to try Android in its fullest entirety, all of the bells and whistles, and I'm kind of enjoying, if I'm being honest, I'm kind of enjoying it a lot more than I anticipated.
No, I definitely see that. From minimalism, relative minimalism to something more
maximalism. maximalism. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely maximum.
But then, I guess to go back to the original point, I think all of this just feels now, why has Samsung failed so drastically at being able to get the devices updated? The biggest, I mean, let's not sugarcoat it. Samsung is Android. Samsung is the poster child for Android. They carry the torch. They carry the flag. They plant the flag. They are, for all intents and purposes, the biggest smartphone maker on the planet. I think it's 1 in 10 in the US phones or 2 in 10 in the US is a Samsung phone, based upon sales figures recently. Don't quote me on that though. I think I might be quoting something a little bit out of date, but yeah, how have they fumbled this so badly? Are they focusing too much on upcoming releases, or are they, I don't know, what will we ever find an answer? They seem to be a little bit behind closed doors about their response to this recent failed rollout.
And it's not like Android 15 was the biggest release ever.
No. No, it's quite small, right?
Yeah. Especially from the underpinning standpoint. But yeah, it's, I don't know, the oddity of when Android 16 starts rolling out, which does not look good. I guess what the thing we'll see is Google, I think they made a point of saying, as part of the accelerated release timeline for Android 16, that they'll be trying to get as many partners on board or something like that. So hopefully that pans out, or I'm not sure if this is a bit of a discussion, a reflection of Samsung and how it can release software, or whether Google needs to continue to simplify how Android releases are shipped to OEM partners.
I mean, I can only assume that a game-breaking bug has been found. I mean, there was no specific answer from Samsung of why they had to pull the OTAs, but it doesn't look good. I think it doesn't look good on anyone involved, because, like I say, they are such a big player in the space that when you see Oppo and Xiaomi able to get their Android 15 update, which, as you alluded to there, is quite a small update, was so quick out of the gate, releasing phones with Android 15 pre-installed. I think Samsung only has two They have two or three devices. One tablet, I think Tab S10 FE or something like that, is running 15. The S25 series is running 15. The A, I want to say 36 and 56 are running 15. So how are they able to get the full fat, fully fledged update yet? They can't push it if it's only a tiny little thing for other devices. Yeah, it's a strange one. But I guess it's compounded again because we've seen leaks of One UI 8. So we could have this really concertina or like kind of crash into effect where by the time Android 16 comes out for Pixel, there's going to be some Samsung devices that get updated to Android 15 in the next couple of months when the rollout starts again. And then within a few months, they're going to be on One UI 8, aka Android 16. So I guess it's value for money, I guess. If you buy a phone now at discounted and you get two updates within a few months of each other, that's something that I guess a few years ago we would have only dreamed to have with Samsung phones.
Yes, this is a bit playing devil's advocate, I guess. but let's take the US market as an example. Let's... like you were saying, Samsung is Android largest player, what people most associate with. In terms of the average user, how much do you think they care about getting these updates? Because the thing that Apple still has going for them years and years later is that you get one where you know when the next version of iOS is coming out. It's coming in the fall. I would argue that its importance is diminishing year over year in terms of the novelty has kind of worn off. What percentage of people care about getting the next One UI update? Because it's, I know like this year especially, they've been pushing past few years, they've been pushing the AI stuff pretty heavily. But I do wonder just the distributed nature of how Android app updates and Google's delivering Gemini at a constant pace outside of the OS, how much it matters. And of course, we have the design tweaks this year, but I do wonder what people's general care for it
is. I think it's a really good point because I guess, and this is anecdotes and the anecdotes are never evidence. When you sometimes see, let's take iOS, for example. I think when you go on social media and you see people talking about a new iOS update comes out, something will change and people will complain about it. You know, your average user. I think, and I hate that term, average user, but what else can we really say? I think a lot of people like to have consistency with their phone and their device. They don't want things to change too drastically because I think humans, on the whole, are quite...
yeah, human
adverse
nature
to change. And I feel like you get I suppose I can use my parents as an example. If something moves in an application, they completely lose they lose their place. They don't know what they're doing. They kind of need advice. They need tech advice, and that is not necessarily a good thing. So maybe these overhauls from us who care about this stuff, probably a little too much in some respects, maybe we are the outlier in a lot of ways. Maybe the average person who's buying a Samsung phone doesn't really care all that much. Like you say, I think I'd love to know figures. Maybe there's a way to find out, and maybe we could poll our readers and see what they say. But I guess if you're an in air quotes enthusiast, you do care, right? I don't know.
So, but yeah, Samsung, they need to have it be widely rolling out before June, which I'm sure they're going 100%. To be there. But just optics-wise, they need to.
Yeah, I think they need to get it out there because they fumbled the bag with this rollout because the longer they wait, the longer it causes problems. But I suppose it kind of is a good thing that we have some other benefits for people who don't care about software updates necessarily. we've seen Astra is rolled out. Have you been using it recently?
This is unexpected. Last week, Monday, we had the wide rollout of Gemini Live's camera and screen sharing capabilities to paid advanced subscribers. That made sense. That's why you have Gemini Advanced. At the same time, Google also said that S25 and Pixel 9 and up owners who you'll get continuous access for free. And turns out we only needed that for 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, because Gemini Live Astra's capable. We need better phrasing there. It's rolling out to everybody as of Wednesday. It's now a free feature for all Android users. And honestly, the pace at this is happening at is surprising to me, because I thought, I think we thought it would be an I/O announcement or something like that about the wide rollout. But the fact that everybody's already getting it is unexpected.
I think it's a good thing though, right? Absolutely. If you have your premier feature, I don't really follow ChatGPT too drastically, but I imagine ChatGPT has their visual search. I think they have a similar product that maybe isn't quite as comparable in terms of like its competencies, but I think that they have one that is free with one of their models. I'm not sure, but I feel like if Google does this, it just puts it in the hands of the people who are going to use it day to day. My biggest problem is I wonder how Google is going to kind of effectively push the message in that this exists. Like you just log in to your phone. You can just sign into Gemini or have the application on your phone, whatever it is, and then start using the visual search. I've always struggled with the fact that the messaging is never necessarily strong enough.
And this honestly dates back to Google Lens, because Google Lens is this powerful visual tool that honestly I think that copying text is the most useful thing for it for a long time. But it's the idea of getting people to point their phone at a something and using it instead of like taking a picture first. It's the idea that the idea of ephemeral images, that you don't really take a picture, you just trust the lens to perform the action. In that regard, I think the biggest encourager of people to get to use Gemini Live is the Gemini overlay, where there's a prominent shortcut to share your screen. Again, I still think like screen sharing is the biggest, is the most obvious use case. Just start it and start talking about what's on your screen. But I think that's a wee bit more natural than still pointing your phone at something.
I disagree. Mm-hmm. I quite like pointing it at something, because it's good to get, like, how would I describe it? The visual search aid. I feel like that's how I'm using it.
Pointing is fine, but pointing and talking, don't you think one step? That's one step. The continuous conversation aspect of it. But yeah, so Gemini Live I think eventually we're going to start forgetting that the voice aspect of Gemini Live is definitely going to merge. So I don't know, but this is effectively Gemini Live 2.0 probably. With the camera and screen sharing capabilities.
How have you been using it? Because I've been using it like just general stuff, like go for a walk with my dog. What kind of tree is that? Just basic things just to test it out. And for the most part, it's been pretty darn solid. I think my biggest gripe at the moment is, and I don't know if this is just a limitation of how Gemini accesses a camera, you can't use the telephoto lens. So when you're out and about and you're doing touristy things, and this is, I kind of mentioned this in when I did my hands-on video last week or the week before, that I've seen some people testing it, and the way they've tested it is like, I don't want to say brain dead, that's a really harsh way to say it, but they've used it in the most generic way possible. Like they've pointed at something, and I understand you can test it and say, oh, what building is this? But you wouldn't do that in the real world. You would use Google Maps, like, oh, what building is this? You would go to Google Maps. What I think the best case usage scenario for Gemini Live video is, you can use it almost like a tour guide, or
good point. It's something you have a conversation with. That's the difference with Google Lens. It's Google Lens is more fact finding. It's a one shot interaction. The point of Gemini Live, which I think society in general still needs to adjust to is talking to their phone in this rich conversational manner. And I probably don't think we're there yet in terms of acceptance. That's why I think like the next phase will be important when you can start accessing the apps/extensions, when you're able to start taking action with Gemini Live. Like, I think the example was you see a picture of something, you invoke the calendar and then to check everybody's schedules, and then you send a message. This was what was shown off at the end of Made by Google last year. So I think the next phase is clearly there. And because right now Gemini Live is still, you have it, it's still for general, not general purpose conversations. The addition of the camera and the screen sharing really extends that. So for the context, so that you don't have to prompt it, you just show. And there's an immense power that you can just show it something and start asking questions. And it'll get better with glasses when that happens. But the power is there. And I think once you can start taking action, it becomes more assistive in the traditional smart assistant sense. I think that's the next phase. And I hope that that's here by year's end, if not sooner.
Oh, I would. It would be amazing to see them to have it ready for Pixel 10 launch.
Yes, absolutely.
Have everything ready for Pixel 10 launch. And I do wonder how many. I'm sure they have plenty of resources allotted to it. But I think this, to begin with, I'm being impressed with it. And in the instances I've used it, even during the testing phase, kind of like putting it through its paces, it's been pretty good. And I quite like it. I do want to use it more. And I agree with you that going out into the world and pointing your phone at something and talking to your phone still feels awkward. I think I'm the kind of person who gets awkward making a video call in public, even with headphones on. So I think maybe I should just try it when I'm out and about this weekend and see how I can get on with it. Because I've used it for problem solving already, like, what is this? How do I fix this problem? And then I obviously Googled it straight afterwards to get the answers, and it's been pretty darn good at it. Like, the object recognition is very, very good. And all you need to do is if you find there's a problem, you can just kind of veer it back on course and it's fine. Like, it might misidentify something because it's far away and it's, I'm guessing, in its own viewport. And I think that's why I think they need to start making sure that now that it's available on lots of devices, that you can access all of those cameras on the phone, for instance, because we have good telephoto lenses on all our phones now.
You don't want to be zooming in as close as possible. You don't
need to. Yeah, basically.
That's why we have three lenses.
Yeah, and I think in that aspect, it's very, very good at that. And in tandem with Circle to Search, I feel like it could be maybe you could just go live from Circle to Search into Gemini again and go way beyond whatever Google Lens could have ever done. I feel weird saying it. I'm a little bit more excited about this because this feels like real-world application of AI as opposed to
absolutely
go to a website, typing prompt, get something out of it. This feels a bit more like simplified, if the interactions are there. But yeah,
again, it's a conversation. That's what people need to get used to.
Definitely. We're getting close to your dream future of her in reality, though, Abner. So I'm kind of pleased for you because I know that you really like that film. And then those.
I like the world of the movie. I think everybody has forgotten what actually happens at the end. So yeah.
What about Gemini Live? Yeah, we've discussed Gemini Live. There's another thing that you've showed me pre.
We talked about it before. VO2 video generation. It's now rolling out to Gemini Advanced subscribers. This is very much a paid feature, in that you can describe a prompt, a paragraph long prompt, and you can create a, 8-second video, 720p landscape. Yeah, and it's, I personally don't have a use case for this besides novelty, which that I'm curious about adoption because, and practical usage, but it is cool. It is undeniably, if you think it, you can see it. That's the phase that AI is in right now.
I feel like the demos that we showed when we played around with it, right? I think with certain things, it is very, very good. It's very lifelike. There's always a little tell. I feel like there's always a little tell. We're even at a point now where you're getting hyper-realistic things, and the stills can look perfect. But when it starts when these videos start moving, maybe it's the resolution issue. But again, I'm very interested to see who will utilize VO to its maximum, because I feel like it may be used. From what I can tell, I think it may be mostly used by marketeers and anyone marketing something. Like, you don't necessarily have to get clearance to get a clip of something. You don't need to pay licensing fees potentially for like something that's generated of a beach, for instance, or a holiday resort.
You don't have to go out and shoot it. And
yeah, I think it's fine for the most generic things possible, and maybe talking from a video creation perspective, I can't see myself ever using it unless it was to illustrate a point on something that would be stock video, for instance, like a drone shot over a mountainscape, or you did an example of a puppy running through snow, and I think that's probably the kind of example that you could do. But I wonder how they're going to combat potential nefarious use of this. How are the guardrails? I've not tested
every
really.
Every frame is watermarked with the SynthID technology. It's in using it. It's in the Gemini app. It's basically just a prompt. You just like any other like image generation. That's what you should be imagining. Don't think the UI is there right now. I think creating a video clip is. It would be helpful if you had a panel that you can adjust like camera views, or you can specify the theme. Again, the prompt box right now, I think, is limiting in terms of it doesn't showcase the full potential of what you can do in terms of the advanced techniques, advanced styles, panning, that kind of stuff. So I hope that's the next phase. But in the short term, there is the novelty aspect of it. And I think given the competition that Google needs to offer something like this, I just don't think it's by any sense a killer feature or a killer add-on to the main Gemini offering.
I do wonder do you think people are going to pay for this? I feel like maybe if it was
only
a standalone.
As part of something. Oh, that's
yeah. I feel like if you had a standalone creation suite, people might use it. But I guess the AI bros would be obsessed with it. I do wonder what the limits. To me, it seems a bit limited. I'm gonna have that biased viewpoint as a guy who points a camera at things for a living. So I can't imagine it's gonna do. It's going to take over certain aspects of the industry for a long, long time.
No, it's exactly like image generation. It's a novelty right now. There are use cases in like, I think one of the more compelling use cases for, let's say, image generation in Google Slides is if you're working on a report and a report that you just show to some people, it's not something you publicly publish. Yeah, images, getting the exact image you want is nice, convenient. Mm-hmm. I kind of question whether it's acceptable for a school report or whether that's a step too much. But like image generation, I think video generation is a nice novelty. And I think the next phase of it is creating a proper tool or proper, you know, it's YouTube, isn't it? It's you give it to YouTube. YouTube makes some kind of advanced. There's a YouTube. What's the name of the editor app that they're still in beta?
You've caught me off guard. I can't remember what it's called. Yeah, I know the one you mean.
Icon, but for the life of me, I can't remember the name. Anyways, that seems like YouTube AI premium or whatever YouTube tier for creators offering that kind of tool. I mean, Google has Video FX, it's in Labs. Mm-hmm. With some of that stuff, but I don't know. The idea is that you can clearly see that as a product for the creator community. I don't think it'll be free. I don't think it's. I don't think you even want it to be free, because you need to. There's a cost to all this, and at the same time, you don't want everybody to have it.
Yeah, I think kind of my final word on it would be that I feel like it could, if Google goes down the route of making an add-on or a tool that potentially plugs into other pieces of software, Premiere Pro, DaVinci Resolve, Final Cut, that kind of thing, I think they could maybe have it as a tool that maybe does things like generic stock photos and videos. Maybe if it's feasible, I haven't been able to test it, and I might try this as soon as we finish recording, is text and kind of like lower thirds, animated text, graphs, that kind of thing. I feel like it could do effectively motion graphics. If the AI can do motion graphics to a certain extent, it might be actually a useful tool. But then mm-hmm. I guess someone who's very competent at those things, and I'm not going to call myself competent at motion graphics, but certain things I could do probably quicker than the actual 1 to 2 minute generation time. And the 720p limitation is a bit frustrating as well. Like, I understand why, because there's going to be a lot of people using it and it probably uses a lot of resources. But yeah, 720p probably does limit the actual feasibility of it. And that's why I think we may end up just seeing it in ads, like social media ads and like on page. We obviously know Google has a big ads platform. So I could very much see that AI being AI image and video generation, especially VO, utilized there. But yeah, I think it kind of haven't had a great deal of stuff to discuss this week. We are expecting Android 16 beta 4 as of recording. We don't expect much to be arriving in that. I don't know about you, Abner. Are you kind of anticipating a beta 5, or do we think that beta 4 is the very, very end, and then
I think we'll get like beta 4.1 with the May security patch winding things down again? I think what's very much happening at this point is that the QPRs will be delivering the bigger features that we might have wanted with the traditional 16 first release. So yeah, I think that's something to look forward to in terms of design tweaks. I am curious how they handle Android 16 at I/O, whether... I/O is going to be a tricky one.
I think
one.
I've said it before. I think my big bet this year is that they just reveal what's coming and kind of say, hey, and in air quotes, the dream would be that they roll out Android 16 at I/O and the same day we all get Android 16. I agree with you to an extent. I can't see it happening because of the timelines, and I don't think, but I mean, stranger things have happened. We've not seen much rollout, but sorry, not much in terms of this rollout of this pre-release of Android 16. But yeah, more stuff coming over the next few weeks as we get up to I/O. It's been a strange one because we're kind of in that lull period after the Pixel 9a launch, and we're kind of gearing up for Pixel 10 and I/O in between. This is the new Google kind of launch schedule, as it were. But yeah, I just want to say thanks for joining me. This has been episode 50, guys. It's been 50 episodes of me and Abner just talking your ear off. I'm glad you joined us. If you want to rate and review the podcast, that helps us out more than you probably know. I'd really love that if you could do that across all of the platforms. And thanks for joining me today, Abner, as always, and I'll speak to you soon.
Bye.